So Moneyball is obviously a great example of innovation. You have a small market team. They get in front of the analytics revolution. They figure out how to find undervalued players. But the point of my talk is that teams and have always been trying to do this. They've always been looking for strategic innovations and how to get ahead in baseball. And I'm going to try and categorize that a little bit and talk about some of the examples. What I'm going to talk about is all off the field. So the shift, use of relief pitchers are not part of what I'm going to talk about. Having said that, I'm going to do this the old-fashioned way. I really like this picture, which gives just a good sense of sort of how innovation can matter. This is the 1896 start of the 100-meter dash at the Athens Olympics. As you can see at this point, nobody really knows how to run a 100-yard dash the fastest. There's actually five different stances. And the guy who won is Tom Burke, who's from Boston, and he's down there in that crouch stance. And so the idea here is obviously that through looking at things a different way and testing, there are ways to get an advantage over other teams. So as I look at it, there's really four ways to innovate relative to baseball and how to get ahead, again, when we're talking about off the field. First of all, there's the player pool. Where are teams getting their players? Where are you finding, are there new sources that other people haven't yet figured out? Secondly is sort of the analytics and intelligence, the Moneyball approach, and then sort of where we've gone today, which is well beyond that. Player scouting and training. Are there ways to get ahead in player scouting and training? What are some of the new techniques? What are techniques people have done along the way to get ahead there? And then lastly is organizational. Are there better ways to build an organization in baseball that can give you a leg up? And I'm going to put this into sort of a larger context by, if you take a lot of the innovations that have happened throughout baseball history, you can see that there are wider context parallels going on in the larger world. Whether or not these were sort of specifically in mind when somebody did something is obviously unknowable, but clearly you can see that there's stuff going on. So let's start with the player pool. And I think the most obvious one is Branch Rickey and the farm system. And if you look in the early 20th century, you had industries that were vertically integrating. Sears was starting to buy factories. And I'm not saying any of this actually went into Branch Rickey's consciousness, but clearly this whole idea of vertical integration was going on. As you guys know, in the 1920s, 1910s, teams would get players from, they would get players basically by either drafting them or buying them from the minor leagues, which took money. Rickey's St. Louis Cardinals, not surprisingly, had no money at the time. And so he came up with this idea of the farm system for the acquisition of players. And that was a huge, obviously, advantage for them, as the Cardinals of the late 20s and 1930s were either the best or one of the best teams in the National League. The other obvious example is Branch Rickey again and the whole player pool. We're coming out of World War II. I think there's this heightened awareness of the fact that black Americans are clearly discriminated against. We're in this fight for freedom from tyranny, and all of a sudden back home, people start realizing what's going on. It gives a little bit of an opening for Rickey, even against fairly strong odds, and Robinson to get into baseball and integrate it. Bill Veeck obviously integrated the American League. But the narrow point here is that the teams that integrated first were the best teams. I mean, the Braves, the Giants, the Dodgers were the three best teams in the National League from about 1950 to 1960, and those were clearly the three teams that integrated first. If you look at the American League, the only two teams that really challenged the Yankees were the White Sox and the Indians, which again were the two teams that were the most integrated. So again, the innovation here, trying to figure out, are there other places we can find talent other than simply buying them or signing minor leaguers or building a farm system? Here's another way. Another one that I really like, and I've talked about this before, is Ewing Kauffman and the Kansas City Royals. In 1969, when he bought the expansion Royals, it was probably as hard a time as ever in history to build a baseball team. With 1965, you had the draft, so you couldn't sign amateur players anymore, and you didn't yet have free agency that was going to come in 1976. Kauffman was a pharmaceutical entrepreneur. One of the things that he did to build his company, Marion Laboratories, was to developed very sophisticated sales programs, sales recognition programs. So he was trying to figure out, is there ways to find baseball players? His idea was to build this academy where he could find players that were not drafted, that were great athletes, football, basketball, players that weren't drafted, weren't baseball players, and turned them into baseball players. It was a really fun story. It was a great idea. It didn't work, but Coffin was an extremely original thinker, and part of the reason that the Royals, I think, got good so quickly and were good for so long, and from the mid-70s to the mid-80s, was because of Kauffman's original approach to looking at the world. And then the Dominican academies. Pat Gillick, who was the GM of the Blue Jays in the late 1970s, had been friends with Epi Guerrero for a long time. When Gillick was a scout for the Astros during the mid-60s, he and Guerrero had signed Cesar Cedeño. So the two of them went a long way back. In the late 1970s, Guerrero was looking for about $9,000 to establish what we now would think of as sort of a proto-Dominican academy. The Blue Jays funded that, and their teams of the 80s, the two World Series teams of 1992 and 1993, were very dependent on international players. And clearly Gillick, who had been looking for another way to get players, original thinker, obviously later with Kaz Sasaki and Ichiro Suzuki, he was always looking for interesting new ways, places to find baseball players. So let's move on a little bit to the second thing that I talked about for innovation, and that's analytics and intelligence. So coming out of the 1920s and into World War II, you had a whole lot of applied mathematics which were going on, industrial psychology. A lot of this stuff was accelerated by World War II as, you know, code breaking. A lot of the ideas of this stuff was going on. One of the fun stories, and I think it may have been talked about here before, is Phil Wrigley hired Coleman Griffith as a sort of a statistician / psychologist in the late 1930s. Now, Phil Wrigley was kind of a goofy guy. He had hired a guy to put the evil eye on other teams. He was looking for original ideas. Some made more sense, obviously, than others. But Griffith, the Cubs in the late 30s tracked basically what we think of today as tracking stuff out of StatCast, where each pitch went, where it was hit, what type of pitch it was, where in the strike zone it was. And the Cubs were very much at the forefront of this. It obviously didn't really help them much, but they were clearly at the forefront of trying to do this. Another sort of proto thing here that's been talked about before is Alan Roth and the Brooklyn Dodgers. Roth and Andy McHugh has written about this a little bit. I mean, Sandy Koufax credited Roth for figuring out the importance of first pitch strikes. Coach Pete Reeser for the Dodgers used to have cards of how each batter did against other pitchers, both righty and lefties, and individual pitchers, which was very unique for the time. So there was stuff going on. That bottom formula is Alan Ross sort of weighted runs created formula from the 1950s. And if you look at it, it's actually not, it's pretty close to what we think about today as good math. Moneyball, I don't really need to talk about Moneyball. I think we've talked about it enough. I just like showing this because it's a chance to show a gratuitous picture of me sitting next to Michael Lewis at a book signing. Thank you. The Giants, who won the World Series 10, 12, and 14, were very much at the forefront of technology, which moved way beyond Moneyball at this time, which was looking at sort of 100 years of statistics, of public statistics, to looking at a lot of other things. The Giants were very much at the forefront of taking advantage of the fact that they were right next to Silicon Valley and sort of incorporating some of that thinking. Bill Newcomb, who was the managing general partner, had been the general counsel of Microsoft, and so he was very much at the forefront of that. The team married, you know, the pitch FX was very much a focus of the Giants. Injury data sets. Stan Conte, who was the trainer, was very much at the forefront of finding those, going to insurance companies and finding that. And then just strategic type of thinking. And then this has gone on today. We're way past all of that. We now, as you guys all know, have StatCast, which is high-speed video, which is looking at and video high-speed computing, and we're learning all sorts of new things. One of the interesting things that's coming out of all this is unanticipated new insights. PitchFX, which was designed to look at pitcher speed, release point, where the pitch went, that's where we got catcher framing out of. So as people started looking at that. So it's very interesting to try and figure out what some of the new insights might come out of StatCast. Each game puts out 80 gigabytes of compressed data. So as these teams figure out how to sort of mine this stuff, there's a lot of stuff, a lot of interesting stuff to come out of that. Player scouting and training, just a quick examples. The Milwaukee Braves in the 1950s were using something called a tachistoscope, which was used in World War II to sort of train pilots. Some of you guys might have seen these when we were little in elementary school. There'd be this flash on a screen for about a fifth of a second, and the idea was how could you recognize it. The Braves actually brought in a woman off the faculty named Alice Richardson from the University of Wisconsin, and she would train the players both from a scouting kind of thing to see who was good at this, and then also as a training technique. So a lot of this stuff is for scouting, but you can also then use it for training. The swing speed monitor, this was sort of a preliminary way to figure out how fast people were swinging the bat. The Dodgers actually bought 30 of these and gave them to all of their minor league teams. They were at the forefront of using the swing speed monitor. I think it's interesting that you take the best teams, the Braves and the Dodgers of the 50s, and they were clearly the most innovative on a number of different levels. And then this pitch speed monitor at the bottom, invented by a guy in Philadelphia. I can't find a record of it ever being used in a major league team, but essentially it was sort of a gimmicky thing. There was two electric eyes. A high school kid would throw a ball into it, and they'd try and figure out which prep kid in Philadelphia could throw the ball the fastest. But there's no real record of it ever being used in the major leagues. Continue on player scouting and training. Today we have all of these crazy new techniques. The MODIS throw is a sleeve that pitchers wear, and you can measure all sorts of stuff, elbow torque, et cetera. The blast motion bat sensor is now, you can now do that in the minor leagues. You can use them in minor league games on the bat, measuring bat speed, launch angle, all sorts of other stuff that you can't necessarily get through StatCast. The minor league stadiums all now have the TrackMan, so you can measure that kind of stuff as well. KineTrax is about a 12-camera system that's set up so you can get a 3D picture of what a pitcher is doing, and you can get a lot more sort of relative to their injury propensity and if they're changing their motion. The interesting thing, KineTrax, both the Tampa Bay Rays and the Cubs have been publicly associated with it. Supposedly a lot of teams are using it, but they're not necessarily making it public. And again, you look at the wider world going on around this, as you had lots more measurement going on back, this Taylorism and the ideas of measuring people in the workplace. There was an article not all that long ago in the New York Times regarding how Amazon sort of trying to figure out how to measure their white-collar workers. It's a little bit less insidious in sport, which is by definition something you have to measure, but I think it's clear that this is all part of something that's going on in the wider society, and the teams are very secretive about what they're doing. I would say that sort of one of the downfalls or pitfalls of these bat motions and these things, as Frank Cannelli was talking about this morning, I mean, we now have 11-year-olds, you know, instead of going out and playing with their friends, they're getting, you know, video, they're having video coaches break down their swings, and it's a different world for trying to get youth to play sports these days. And then the last part was the organizational. I think, you know, you had Jacob Rupert take over the Yankees in the late teens, and Rupert is the owner. He was a brewer, and breweries had management. And in baseball at the time, generally there was no general manager up until about 1920. You had the owner and you had the manager, and depending on their relative strengths, one of them would sort of build the team. And Rupert, a little bit Phil Ball, who owned the Browns and was an ice plant manufacturer, he also brought in a general manager. They figured out that if you could create that role in the middle, take the manager out of it, take the owner who probably didn't know a whole lot about baseball, unless it was maybe Charlie Comiskey, then you could create a better way to build a team. And if you look, the teams that were the best in the 1920s and the 1930s were the teams that sort of brought in a general manager first. The teams that didn't sort of stumbled along for a while. The Yankees hired Barrow in the fall of 1920, and I think that was a very key moment in them being able to build that team. And then, you know, we go to today. So this is the Cubs front office from their media guide in 2002. There's about 31 people there. You're not supposed to be able to read all those positions. The media guides are available. But, you know, they had... Unlike the old days where you sort of had a scouting director and a farm director and a GM. By 2002, this is a group of 31 people between operations, senior minor league people, medical, and scouting. And again, we have this sort of this whole new focus on business management out there today. And so we got to 31 people in 2002. This is 2018. We're now about 70 people in the Cubs front office associated with baseball operations and the medical staff. And there's just multiple, you know, there's just multiple coordinators of advanced scouting and many things. So clearly this has changed. So to wrap this up, I think, you know, looking for wider context parallels are one of the interesting ways to try and find innovative ways to build a baseball team. And, you know, success and acceptance depends on a couple of things. First of all, is it going to work? And if it works, that's sort of the first thing you need to do to get any interest in it. Organizational buy-in. What's interesting, so for example, with Coleman Griffith and the Cubs, is that not surprisingly, a couple of old guys like Gabby Hartnett and Charlie Grimm, when they were each managing, had zero interest in listening to anything Coleman Griffith had to say. And, you know, I don't know that Phil Wrigley really sold it to them very well. Jimmy Wilson, actually, when he became manager and they were still tracking some of this stuff in their early 40s, was actually surprisingly interested in it. But by that time, I think it was probably a little bit late, and Wrigley was sort of moving on to his next idea. And unfortunately, that was really the only one good one he had. How disruptive will it be? The general manager, if you have a manager who likes to run things or an owner who likes to run things, they're not going to give up their spot to bring in somebody new. So part of the reason it took so long for the general manager to become productive or to become throughout baseball is that people didn't necessarily want to give up their control over building a team. And then lastly, is it worth doing? You know, the Royals Baseball Academy is really a great story, and a couple of players came out of it. Frank White, most notably, UL Washington also came out of it. But the negatives there is that it was costing Kauffman about $600,000 a year to run that farm system and run that program, and it cost him about $800,000 to run all the rest of the farm system. And so clearly for that kind of money, it was mid-1970s, 1973, 1974, Marion Laboratories stock was getting hit in the recession, and Marion Laboratories, and so Kauffman just canceled the program. I think later he said that was one of his biggest regrets, was canceling the Baseball Academy. So in closing, I think the idea here is that teams have always been looking for interesting ways to get ahead. And one of the ways to think about that is to sort of look at the wider world for context as a way for the general managers or these teams to look for new ways to try and win in baseball. Thank you. Questions?
Hi, great stuff. Hello.
Thank you.
Okay, I'll talk very loud. Okay, great stuff. Love it.
Okay, there we go. So, you know, there's been a lot of progress in this kind of thing, in statistical front and player acquisition and whatnot. I think probably the next frontier would probably be some way of quantifying player acuity in terms of psychological makeup or interpersonal relations. And I think a lot of teams are doing the former. Most, if not all, the teams are doing something in the former. I don't know if anybody's doing anything in terms of interpersonal relationships, how the relationships between players, and quantifying that could actually give teams insights into which players might succeed under which kind of systems. And I'm wondering if you've looked at any of that and what you know about any of it.
A couple of things. A lot of teams are doing neuroscience testing as a way to try and figure some of that out, both from a psychological profile and from the sort of the muscle-eye kind of relationship. Mm-hmm. The Red Sox are in the forefront of that. Regarding team chemistry, a lot of teams are studying it. I know that the Cubs have created this new, they now have a circular clubhouse as a way to try and foster relationships and friendships and contact between the mm-hmm. players. I don't know how they're trying to measure whether or not that works. Joe Madden's got his own approach to the world. But right. teams are clearly trying to do that stuff.
Sure, yeah. I can't believe they're not trying to quantify it right. In some way. I just wondered if there's any record of it anywhere. So,
I have not heard that.
Yeah, great. Thank you.
Do you think that the increasing use and implementation of analytics is increasing or decreasing fan enjoyment of the game?
Well, I guess I would give you a different, I'll answer sort of a different question. My sense is that it is incumbent on the teams and the players to try and win. And that if Major League Baseball thinks that that is making things tougher, then they need to sort of, as Frank was talking about, this, Connelly was talking about this morning, fix that. I like watching balls in play as much as the next guy. I think all the strikeouts have changed the nature of the game. So personally, I think so. But again, I think that's on baseball to fix, and I think that teams, it's their job to try and win.
Thank you.
Somewhat in relation to that, so some of the historical stuff that you presented quite well was kind of out there because owners were really kind of excited to brag about the way they were, yeah, that's right, boys, we're going to figure out the new way to play baseball. Right. But that's, like you were mentioning, much less popular now. Going forward, do you think a presentation like this could be given in the next 20 or 30 years the same kind of, I don't know, detail that it was given for the past, you know, 70 years or so?
Well, I think all the stuff sort of comes out in retrospect. I think people are, I mean, I think the Astros are worried about, you know, the Indians stealing what they have probably today. I think in 10 years, I think Jeff Luhnow would probably be fairly open about talking what they were doing in, you know, in 2018. But the other thing I would just say is that just between teams, there's a lot of movement of analysts between teams. And so I think teams rightfully try and keep some secret, but you know, I mean, it's hard in a fairly tight industry like that where people get promoted between teams. You know, I mean, right? That's Luhnow and Sig Megdal go over to Houston, and you know the guy from the Cardinals is trying to, you know, steal their data to see what they're taking from them. So, yeah, I think historically you'll be able to figure stuff out going backwards. I think it's very tough for a year or two to know what the Astros or the Dodgers are doing.
Thank you.
Have you seen any differences in the way teams approach instructional techniques in what you're looking at over the years?
Sure. I mean, I think that, you know, if you take a look at that Baseball Academy, one of the beauties of the Baseball Academy was that the Royals actually looked at that stuff. They were testing, they were using a stopwatch to figure out how big a lead to get. And one of the reasons the Royals were so good at base stealing in the 70s, Steve Boris, who was one of the coaches there, gives credit to the Baseball Academy for learning new techniques. You know, Coleman Griffith, when he was trying to do this, you know, the stuff for the Cubs, he was also looking at sort of ways. He was talking about ways to play pepper better, that you should try and move closer as you play pepper as a way to sort of build up the reflexes. So teams have been trying to do that stuff.
In the past couple decades, there's been trends in a lot of industries toward outsourcing, so having contract organizations perform functions that would otherwise be done in-house. Do you anticipate anything in the scouting or analytics field of a, you know, an independent organization that teams would go to and cut contracts for performing functions for them?
I think you'll see that in data sources. As most of you guys remember, back in 1974, they started something called the Major League Scouting Bureau, and then a lot of teams cut their scouts as a way to save money. And Pat Gillick, when he took over the Blue Jays, he pulled the Blue Jays out of the Major League Scouting Bureau because they wanted to do their own scouting. They didn't want to be dependent on this stuff. And the Scouting Bureau in the last couple of years has been done to just sort of figure out which players were eligible, as all the teams have wanted to bring that stuff in-house. So I think that there'll be certain things like buying data sources, but the actual intelligence, I think, is very much going to be held within the team level.
Great presentation. One more. Have you seen the use of augmented reality or virtual reality or simulations being used more by ball clubs to look at specific situations?
Well, the teams have been talking about doing it mainly in the sense of you're almost getting to the point where you can take a pitcher and model a pitcher who's going to throw, even if a player who's never seen him before, and you can create this sort of this virtual reality for a batter of facing a pitcher, which is getting really close to being very lifelike. That is the main place that I've seen it used so far.
Thank you.
Thank you.